Ladies and gentlemen, just about 3 weeks ago, that is tomorrow morning, 3 weeks ago, I had arrived at Ithaca. Chuck Pearman drove me to Heller House. I was here. And now I'd like to have the first slides, please. When I approached later in the day the kitchen door, this is what I saw. Let's look at the left. You see two perfectly good pencils. And between the stepping stones and the first flagstone on the ground, you see a bottle of some kind of mouthwash. And then a red spot you probably recognize. This is a little piece of a broken plastic bottle top. And further in the foreground, the white egg shape is the broken off front part of a plastic spoon. And between the second pencil, further on the right, and that white spot, there are some remains, some of a canine nature. Now, did this shock me? Certainly not. I thought, that's that, and moved on. In the kitchen, I found a jar of horseradish on the shelf. It had a fur like blue cheese and would have made a horse horse. Did I clean up the mess? I could have used a good pencil, but I played fascinated with a kind of swiveling handle of the faucet of the sink, presumably designed to give the housewife the feeling she was on the controls of a Boeing 747. Now, this view brought back another view I had seen several years ago. Next slide, please. On a beautiful beach, a little back in Sardinia, I found this, which the impression on the left brought to my mind. And the next slide, another came to my mind, this view near Zurich, but it could be near Basel in Switzerland. It could be almost anywhere. You see, at first sight, one would claim that both are equally senseless, garbage. And garbage they are, leftovers, but by no means senseless. We can see, for instance, on the right, in that scene in the back of a beach in Sardinia, that over there on the upper left, where that box can be recognized, that's probably where the mother was sitting with the stuff. She kept the youngster close to her. And here, where there are two bottles of beer, empty of course, there probably was the father sitting during the picnic with the oldest son. And here in the foreground, the youngsters were fooling with their food. So all that makes sense. It is a precise trace of life. And so, in the townscape on the left, we also perceive the record of a moment and of opportunity. We see tall buildings, high-rise, office buildings probably, then quite in the foreground, the lowest shape with a dark roof is housing, flat. There are factories, and there are parking lots in between. And the next picture. And somewhere in the plains of Texas, this town was laid out. 1819. You see the railroad track coming in from the left. A train is just arriving in that description. And there is a station, of course. And from that station are laid out the streets in a well-known gridiron pattern. They had no spatial meaning whatever. They were not meant to have a meaning in terms of space. They were not to create an architectural space or organize it. They had just a legal meaning. Make the surface of the earth like a piece of fabric to be cut up for using, available and usable. And so, again, we have to look a little closer at the picture, although we all know it, and you know it probably better than I. One could see that starting from the station, from the depot, at this point, a main street was designated, one of many equal streets. But this happened to be Main Street. It just was determined like that. And the first business district, no doubt a hotel, was developed around this part. There was a concentration of shops and of business. Then there is a church right here, and the second one. And then, of course, the houses here and there, as the opportunity, the moment, and the accident of life made it possible. And then factories, moreover, where there was water power available, all very reasonable and logical, by no means senseless. But is not all this, with all the geometric order of rectilinear organization, completely accidental and transitory? Not senseless, I repeat, but something that existed rather in time than in space, easily wiped off or abandoned like so much garbage. A frontier town. Next. I have now to talk about the peculiarly American notion of frontier. At Geneva, in Switzerland, there, since time immemorial, when Caesar stopped the Helvetians and prevented them from moving west because they wanted to leave the pre-Alpine hills that make up most of that part which one calls flat in Switzerland. Even then, Geneva was a frontier. So was Basel. At the upper end of the Alsatian Valley, at a crossing of the Rhine River from France to Germany. It was a frontier like Geneva, and like many other places in Europe, are on frontiers. And the frontier, divided, separated, or connected, of course, it was something to be respected or fought, but in that sense, at any rate, accepted, something that was always there, not an ocean of transition or of a transitory nation. It was one thing that frontier in Europe was certainly not, something merely temporal, epitomizing the transitory. It could change, of course. Wars, heritages, dynastic changes made that possible. But its very nature and meaning derived from being something existing in space. and not being a phenomenon in time. It was in space primarily. So there could be, to borrow Franz Oswald's happy expression, in these places a sedimentation. In America, ever since the very beginning of colonization, the frontier was something that signaled an only temporary halt, a stop sign that would be moved on shortly. The frontier was not border of the territory I was in, but the gate to where I was to move on. The next slide, please. There was always a new horizon out west. So whenever and wherever the farmer had exhausted the land in his clearing or at the fringe of a plain, he moved on, for there was plenty more to get and use, and natural resources in inexhaustible supply there to be exploited. So man moved on, left behind when a situation had become unsatisfactory or untenable. Now we can cut the slides. And this, as a process, could go on forever. At least it went on. Well, you can turn off the slides, please. Thank you. At least it went on for over 300 years. It was only in the 1930s, during the Depression, that it had become inescapably evident that there was the last frontier. As the new immigrants, Americans this time already, wanted to leave the man-made desert of Oklahoma's dust bowls behind and once more moved west, they found no new paradise, but roadblocks to prevent them from crossing the frontier to California. And when 30 years later, a new frontier was designated, beyond which one could move with the Apollo vehicle or the psychedelic trip, it was evident that this merely demonstrated a concept that had become only habit, supported by technological advance. Recent traditions and present positions in urban design theory. In this series, we learned that Le Corbusier had a reverence for history, that is a quotation, that he responded to the challenge of the present, and that he had, in addition to these two, as a third element in his work, a very personal way. But whoever needed rather lame or tame protestations that we need history as present? And do we have to trouble good old Corbusier for to talk like a ghost through a Ouija board at the spiritualist seance, that we may understand that the past is an eternal present? And have we seen frustrated egomaniacs who parade their projects like a red herring before our astonished eyes to demonstrate that they did their tourists' round trip of sightseeing through history? No doubt, everybody is now on the bandwagon and will join the act. And interest in history is in for the architect. But is this not the old endurable American concept of the frontier. It has undergone a metamorphosis and reappeared like a Freudian repression in the current interest in history. Presumably interest in history because we want to preserve the historic heritage, or ostensibly because we respect it as precedent. But once more, one can deal with a vast territory, as once were the prairies of the Middle West or the ore deposits of Montana. One can deal with a vast territory that offers no resistance to cheerful exploitations, for no part of it was ever frequented by roving bands of Indians that roam about in quest of game. Now we can have the slides again. It appears that history is conceived as a kind of second nature, as a landscape of memories with seemingly inexhaustible resources to be had for the asking. And so it is to be expected that the simple spectacle that is by no means tragic will be repeated. Next. That the landscape of history, just as the landscape of geography, will be littered by the discarded leftovers of hurried encampments. Next. Again, space is merely a mathematical, physical fact, Cartesian and Newtonian, and not something created at a unique place, rooted in culture, maintained and recreated over and over again as the Roman word cultura meant, the incessant reworking and cultivation of one piece of ground. The next slide. So, perhaps buildings will look different and will be quite excellent as individual pieces, each standing isolated in space as it stands in time, and not being really part of a space which is created and of which the building is part. They will look different and they may be quite excellent, but be again like garbage, forgotten after the picnic. And all dealing with history will be like a picnic, for the duration of a pleasant summer Sunday afternoon, after which the architect will move on. Next. Franz Oswald, who talked in this series, said that he refused, and I quote, to accept tastefully selected imagery as a manifestation of historic consciousness. Or I might add, confusing, that one resists, confusing buildings with the forces that brought them about. To be satisfied with taking history as a quarry in which to select the building blocks for one's own architectural collage. If history is indeed a musée imaginaire, in the wonderful inventive word of André Malraux. It is most certainly, however, not a pattern book. Next. Of course, we have since quite some time the classical eclectic situation. In Webster's dictionary, I find the definition of eclectic. It means selecting, choosing from different sources, or made up of what is selected from different sources, or selecting and using what are considered the best elements of all systems, or elements that derive from a wide range of historic styles, chosen for their fancied appropriateness to local conditions or purpose to be served, etc. Is there anything to be added to that mere dictionary definition? But we need not worry that anything as demanding as the eclectic situation, as anything as demanding as the inescapable moral decision that is implied in selection, is seen, recognized, let alone faced and addressed by most contemporaries. The next. It is far easier to see history as a cheerful supermarket with shelves well stocked with supplies of ready-made. It is not even necessary anymore to produce one's means of livelihood oneself like a farmer. One can insist on relying on an industry to satisfy one's demand for supplies for a private collection of historical souvenirs. And a service industry has indeed sprung up to satisfy this demand for building prototypes and theory. And it is here to stay and to supply instant history for conspicuous consumption. There are institutes, publications, editors, writers, journalists and critics, and of course professors. We have brutalism, structuralism, symbolism, traditionalism, ad hocism, populism, rationalism, contextualism, and realism. There is only one ism, I think, that is never mentioned. The unholy father of them all, exhibitionism. I can imagine quite well that I myself get my share of the market by staking out a claim somewhere in the late 60s and sell functionalism that is post but not yet neo. But most of the theories, conceits, and buildings that are fed us can give no comfort. They are not nourishing like fruit an earth mother gives. They are like the children of Uranus and Saturn. They either castrate their fathers or are devoured by them. by him. There can only be this comfort and this quiet in this. And certainly there will be no sedimentation, only incessant washout. I hear of Baroque space to be created in Ithaca. Siena has already been transferred to Boston. The Place Vendôme, the Place Royale in Paris are offered as precedents of what to do. And Roman palaces are demonstrated to be usable. There is an uncritical mixing of quite different cultures. In the city, one dreams of a Rousseauist countryside and its delight. And in the countryside, one speculates shamelessly with condominium flats in big blocks. Or let me mention Switzerland. It has been said that we are a nation of hotel keepers, which is probably much truer than to suspect us as being the gnomes of the banks of the Bahnhofstrasse. A vacation country, a tourist country particularly, runs in fact the risk of cultural bastardization, be it to please the tourist or because one admires him as a paradigm, or of course for much more material reasons. The profounder, more dangerous, more disturbing reason would be, however, not to know any longer the ground to which one belongs, or to have forgotten one's own values, and the result, insecurity in accepting and developing one's own possibilities. Only a very few years after the protest movement convulsed a new generation in this country and in others, and when to do one's own thing was in, I seem now to see a generation of students of architecture quite prepared to forego their own experience, to rely on the authority of history, and to expect from it, and not from themselves, legitimacy. They pretend to be interested in neoclassicism. And what they take for thinking, it seems to me, is not a firm walk on the grounds of personal observation and experience, but rather a careful checking of utterances with an adopted dogma. They seem to distrust feeling and are quite happy to submit to those most authoritarian means of spatial organization, the axis and bilateral symmetry. Any dialectic, in a Dominican sense, is entirely foreign to them. I think of Telemachus, son of Ulysses, that most illustrious citizen of Ithaca. For more than 20 years, the old man had been away, and Telemachus had heard from his father and his incredible adventures in the dangers of Scylla and Charybdis and Nausicaa. He had heard of his adventures and discoveries. He had traveled the seven seas, and then he was here. What remained to be done for the young? To visit the places where his father had been in order to find his own identity? But I'm often forced to think even more so of Esau, son of Isaac, the older brother of Jacob. You all know the story. The hungry Esau's loss of birthright privilege for a mess of lentil pottage. And how, adding insult to injury, so to speak, he lost his father's preferred stock of blessing by Jacob's crafty deception of his blind parent. You are firstborn. You have the right of first birth and the right for it to find your own. So don't be impatient because you are hungry, like Esau returning from the hunt, and give your birthright away for a mess of historical lentil porridge. What to do, I do not know. Maybe just be silent and lonely and say to so much, I don't want it, I don't care. But for that, one has to be able to wait. You see that image of Esau with that occurred to me when I observe the impatience which brings on the temptation to give up for quick results and apparent discoveries, that which can be only found in what Corbusier called the patient research. I do, of course, remember Bob Dylan and his song. I quote, "How does it feel? How does it feel all alone? How does it feel like a rolling stone?" Now, of course, rolling stone in capital letters, because it is a quotation. History and the quotation of history. But I also remember Le Corbusier, who showed by his work and life that one can willingly, often even cheerfully, accept and embrace the condition humaine. And remember also the central argument in Collage City by Colin Rowe, that it is better to work with small and even contradictory elements than entertain fantasies of a perfect design that the conditions of life can only pervert. That is, of course, sound advice for the architect working in an urban and historical context, but as well for everyone who inevitably, day by day, creates his own life. Thank you.